This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me and associate producer Randy Hare at the fabled Wimberly Glassworks in San Marcos, Texas, for a visit with lead glassblower Wes Wietzer, where he shares his creative passion about crafting legacy works of art for individuals and corporate clients.
Wimberly Glassworks. The owner, the founder, he was a Canadian, right?
He was born in Canada, but he spent most of his life I think he started out in New Jersey, and then Pennsylvania. Went to college in upstate New York and Pennsylvania. Started his first studio in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. Moved down here fairly soon after that. So.
And you went to the same school that he did.
I did. Yeah. It's Alfred University. It's one of the more prestigious glassblowing programs in the country. I just kind of happened into it, though. Going there for other arts, two-dimensional painting, illustration, printmaking.
But you very much started as an art major.
Yeah. Yes, definitely going to school just for art, but I was going all flat. Mm-hmm. We had to have a sculptural element, so had to sign up for a three-dimensional course, and I happened to get into the glassblowing program without even knowing how prestigious it was. So there were, I think, 85 students that signed up for 16 slots, and I got lucky, and just worked really hard.
So how did you get hooked? How did it resonate with you?
Glassblowing is one of those things that once you start, you either quit really fast or you want to do it forever. There's not much in between. There's no casual, like, kind of liked it. I think I'll try and blow glass here and there. You either can't stand the heat and you don't like the fact that you have to break everything while you're learning. Or then there's the people who are just like, I get to break glass all the time and play with fire. But eventually I get this thing and I make something out of it. Yeah.
So ultimate, tangible, tactile, feel it, see it.
And it's immediate, too. The glass, you can't put it down. Like, once you start making something, you have to be there. You have to work on it until it's done. Like, there's no putting it aside, going out for lunch, coming back, working on it later, say until tomorrow. Once you start, you have to finish it.
Yeah. And it's an interesting process, too, in that it's a little more detached from your body than most other art forms.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Because I know you have this temptation. You want to touch it.
That temptation goes away pretty fast.
Yeah, really.
Because you do touch it a couple times, and you should learn really fast. Yeah. If you touch it more than once or twice, you probably should be finding a different hobby.
But isn't that a weird instinct?
Yes.
Because it is. It's so colorful and beautiful, and it doesn't look evil.
Yeah, and every other art form you learn, you know, it's very tactile. You know, you are touching stuff. You can smudge the charcoal around with your fingers, and you've got to, you know, get your fingerprints on the clay. But with glass, you have to do everything through tool. So there's an aspect to it that's almost like learning to play a musical instrument while you're learning how to make something.
Yeah, because there's no other way.
Nope. Yeah. Nope, you have to learn how to play the guitar that happens to make an object instead of a song.
Yeah, very cool. So tell us about how your life morphed. You know, you're in university, you graduate, and then what?
I've actually always been around craftsmen, and, you know, my grandfather's built barns and houses and boats. And at a fairly young age, my mom decided that I was not going to lay in bed reading books all summer and I needed a job, so she kind of sold me off to a friend of the family who was a contractor. And at 15, I started hauling shingles up and down to roofs and learning how to build houses and work with wood. And I kind of figured that I would always be some sort of carpenter that had an illustration habit. So when I got out of college, I, you know, immediately went back to working for the same guy. We had a lot of projects to do, so he needed help. So I, you know, took the most available job, but then decided to come. Well, I'm from New Hampshire, so I grew up in New Hampshire doing all this. Go to school in New York State, and then after college, I decided I didn't want to live at home anymore. So I had some friends that came to Texas for school, and I decided I wanted to just go on a road trip. So I came to Texas, and they're at Texas State in San Marcos. So I decided to sleep on a couch for a few months, and try and see if I could find a some sort of construction carpentry job around here. I knew if it didn't work out, I could still go home again.
Right,
so it was fine. Just had a fun, you know, fun time sleeping on couches for a few months. But while I was trying to find construction work in Texas, as a scrawny kid from New Hampshire, it didn't go so well. I was actually going on a job interview that didn't pan out, but while I was going to the place, I saw a glassblowing studio, and it's like, well, I've got some free time now. I did that in college. I'll go stop and see what they make. That'll be fun. Wound up getting along with everyone that worked there, and found out that the owner had gone to the same college that I did. It also happened out that the owner needed some construction work done on some apartments that he owned and his own house. So we got along talking about the glass blowing, and then I kind of worked my way into by being able to do some renovations for him on the side. And while I was doing that, I slowly kept sneaking into the glass shop more and more.
And when did he realize your talents and kind of formally bring you in?
I'm not even sure if he realized my actual talent at it, but after a few months, he basically realized how hard I worked, you know, how much time I was willing to put in, and attention to detail of things, and the fact that I was managing to balance the renovation work and sneaking into the glass studio and actually helping. But and then I got along with everyone, which is always a plus. Everyone has to work really closely together in the hot shop.
Well, looking in from the outside, it makes sense. I would think that he needs you.
At this point, I would hope so, yeah. Job security is nice.
Yeah.
So. I've been working here for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
So, don't always get along, but it's, I think, you know, I love this place. And
typical family.
Yeah, basically. yep.
Tell us about what you do, what on a, you know, daily, weekly, you are creating, designing, manufacturing, making.
So the company has been around since 1992, and we've always had a really talented, like, rotating cast of workers. So there's always new people coming in, going, bringing in new designs, and we all, you know, collaborate on everything. It's just, I think I want to try this. Okay, let's sit down and design something and make something. And say, oh, that looks terrible, but that one spot on there looks really nice. Let's try and make that spot over the whole thing. And, you know, so try and design organically and just let things grow on their own. That's how you, that's how we usually make some our best designs.
What drives your weekly work schedule? Is it more commission or more
sales? You know, whatever people are buying at the time. Oh, we're out of this color pattern. Make some more of those.
Right. So you're making stuff for inventory.
Yep, inventory and custom orders. So a lot of our lighting, a lot of different lighting. Oh, I like that color pattern, but I need, you know, a chandelier, so I need this many that are this size and shape. And we have so many different combinations. It's
so you do a lot of high-end custom homes.
Yep.
Commercial buildings,
commercial buildings, yeah.
Yeah.
We started getting into large-scale commercial work just right after I came in and started working. Always really fun, and usually lead to a lot of innovation and design, because, you know, you can devote a lot more time to the design. Since you have such a large project, it's easier to spend more time coming up with new patterns and new fixtures and, you know, ways to display things. It's, that's been really good to, good for us, and we've taken a lot of that and translated it into more residential stuff. So
that's kind of your little proving ground for design.
Yeah. A big showpiece, and then say, oh, see this thing with, you know, 50 of these hanging up? here's a small scale one that'll fit in your house.
And do you get spin-off clientele, corporate? One guy will come to one guy's showroom or whatever and go, we want that.
Yeah. The same way a lot of the large projects have spun off from someone was here on vacation. They came in, watched the show, thought it was fun, maybe didn't even buy anything or talk to anybody, but went home, came back a few months later with some more family, maybe bought a lamp, left again, then came back and like, okay, so anyway, I've been here a few times, I've really liked it, but I have this giant thing I want you to do. I'm like, oh, well, really glad that we put on a good show for you and we're friendly and helped you out the times we didn't know you could be a large-scale client.
Right, right. That's so funny.
Yeah. Be really friendly to everybody.
Because you never know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just fun having so many people come through here. Since the studio is open, people can just come in and it's free to watch. So
people, do you ever have just families, random people driving by that see you?
Oh, yeah. There's been so many people. We were just driving by. I had no idea this place was here. And we just slammed the brakes on in the middle of the road and spun around and had to come in.
Very cool. And where are some of the commercial installations that somebody in Central Texas might see?
We've done a lot up in Plano.
Frito-Lay World up there.
Huh? Yep. And Dr. Pepper. Mm-hmm. And she just finished an installation in the new Dr. Pepper headquarters.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
My favorite drink.
Yep. Yep. Texas, gotta love it.
Yeah.
Plano, some out in Houston.
Austin?
A couple in Austin. And then we have some in, like, Los Angeles, a couple in Denver. We'll go anywhere. Anywhere anyone wants us to. We're fine with that.
And you even do installations similar to Cthulhu?
Cthulhu.
Right? Kind of that real flamboyant, explosive.
That's what glass is good for. Like, just really intense pops of color.
Yeah.
Very attention-grabbing. And Cthulhu is fairly ubiquitous in the glass world, and he
has to have like factory assembly line.
He has two factories, and he has people working.
How many workers do you think?
I'm actually not sure.
Random guess, conservatively.
Conservatively, I'll say 30, and they're just making parts all day. Most of his installations are, I'll say, fairly simple, glass blowing wise.
But that repetitive motif.
But that repetitive,
that's what makes it look so dramatic.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting, in anything in art, if you have that nugget of the motif and you repeat it in enough ways, it becomes this design.
Yeah, that was one of the classes I took in college. They would they stressed a lot of that. There is design a unit and design a system. The more units you can have in the system, the more interesting it'll be and the more diverse you can make it. So,
but it's that classic repeat motif.
Exactly.
And the unit itself is very simple.
Exactly. That's the thing. Then if the unit is simple and easy to reproduce, then the system can become more complex, more diverse.
What I find interesting is I travel around the country and you come across these Cthulhu or installations, nobody ever says, you know, it's always, oh, this artist made this.
Yeah.
And most of the people I'm with, you know, they're assuming that this dude is doing it all by himself.
The volume of stuff, he hires a lot of really amazing, amazing glass blowers and amazing, and he does a lot of the designs, but he does a lot of like abstract designs and then someone that has to sit down and say, okay, here's how we actually make this.
So he's like creative director.
Exactly. Exactly. He does fun paintings and then has an amazing Italian master that will sit down and say, okay, so technically we do this, this, and this, pick up that, do that, stretch it up this way, heat that part. Okay, that's how you make that. Now you guys go and make 5,000 of them.
So here at this studio, does your owner come in? Is there a lot of control and command? Or does he allow you guys to kind of have some free reign?
He allows us to have a lot of free reign.
Okay.
But he also does that same, like, okay, I was talking to someone for this thing, this lobby full of something, and they want reds and blues, and they want this. How can we do this? I think we should do this. And I say, and usually I'm the one that's the technical side, and saying, that might not be physically possible, but that's a good idea. We'll work on that. And we kind of go back and forth and make, you know, days worth of prototypes and mm-hmm. then figure out what kind of fixtures can go on, can attach and hang, and like how we can make it so you can hang it and how you can also replace it and pull it down and, or clean it. Mm-hmm. A lot of things don't take into consideration. There's like, it'll look really pretty. It's like, but then it costs them $30,000 to get a, you know, to cover the floor, to get a scissor lift, to get someone up there with a little Swiffer to get all the dust out of it. When we can just say, okay, if you need to do it, just whoop, do that, and mm-hmm. it'll be fine, and you can clean it and put it back up.
Yeah.
So we try and
design
everything.
Yeah. Know. Interesting.
Yeah. Because we've run into that problem a lot where people say, well, this was great, but, oh, how can we change that? We can avoid that problem if we plan for it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But somehow they're just inherent in the environment, and you're stuck with the scissors lift.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes that's all you can do. But yeah.
So, closest to your heart, what makes you tick and keep the passion going? Do you feel as excited and challenged in the morning as you did when your university first hurdles?
Sometimes, mm-hmm. yeah. But really, just whatever you're making, there's the initial stick the pipe in the furnace and turn it just right to get some glass on the end, and mm-hmm. it's the same little glowing orange blob of lava that it was when I started blowing glass, and it's the same for every piece, and that little drippy ball of possibility mm-hmm. and knowing what I need to do to change that into something else, what all the next steps are, but it's still that same basic thing every time, and it's still just as like bright and shiny.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The other thing about the tactile arts of clay and whatnot is you can go to a museum in Europe or whatever and see another artisan's work mm-hmm. tangibly, tactilely, from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you ever trip on that one?
Yes. And where I went to college is a couple hours away from the Corning Museum of Glass. And they have some of the best collection of historical glass anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ancient Roman glass that's slowly disintegrating. Because they didn't know quite the chemical formula. Like, it lasted for them just fine. 2,000 years later, it's the acids in the glass are starting to eat away at it a little bit.
What's the degradation?
I think it's a separation mm-hmm. a little bit. It's actually, you've seen Tiffany lamps. It has that kind of iridescent quality. That was actually based on the slight iridescent quality of the degradation of ancient glass. So he saw that and wanted to reproduce that look without having to have it disintegrate over
right.
thousands of years. So it's that, the tiny little platelets of mm-hmm. glass that are arranged that are just starting to separate a little
right,
bit,
right.
So it catches the light different. So it makes this really nice iridescence.
Did the artisans from 2,000 years ago talk to you?
Yeah. I mean, we still, if you're not feeling as creative in the moment, mm-hmm. you know, making new things and new designs, still, I think every glassblower will just look back at ancient designs and, you know, even factory designs from the 50s, or which were probably based on, you know, Roman designs or Venetian mm-hmm. designs from the 1400s, and just the really creative ways they used, because, you know, it was so intense, it took a lot of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was so resource heavy to get the fire that hot and to get all of the glass. They had to make sure they use all of it. So there's so many techniques that just are the ways to save every little tiny bit of color and little bit of glass and use all the leftover pieces. And so there's so many really interesting creative techniques that are just based on that. So many designs that they had.
Was there any object historic that blew your mind?
Most of them. The techniques are so specific and so hard to achieve even these days with, you know, as many technological advances as we have. Mm-hmm. still hasn't changed that much. We're still using the same basic tools,
mm-hmm.
but just the delicacy and the just precision of a lot of the things and the shape and the forms, and it's, you know, all as aesthetically pleasing as possible, and it's just so hard to achieve without doing it every day, constantly for 20 years.
So that artisan from 2,000 years ago indirectly is speaking to you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or, yeah, I mean, you can, especially once you've done it enough, you can, you know, be looking at something and you can still see their hand, mm-hmm. no matter how precise, and you can still see the little tool marks. You know, mm-hmm. you're like, that's where there's a little flaw right there. That's where he slipped a little bit and kind of just poked a little indention over there. That's not supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. I saw what you did. You know, there's a little extra there that's not quite right. It should be a little bit smoother, but it's mm-hmm. not quite. So you can still, I do love when you can still see the hand of the artist. You can still see the tools. You know, the tools last a long time. So mm-hmm. You can still find, maybe not old Roman tools, but a lot of the tools we have here have been around for 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got some that have been around since the 70s. The tool knows what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's done this one move thousands of times. It's put in that little line. It's squeezed that thing just right. The metal has been worn away just a little bit, so it makes it a little bit easier. And you can tell the difference. Like, I get a new set of tools and try and do the same thing. It's not quite the same. I gotta work these a little bit. These need to get broken in a little bit more.
That's really cool. Yeah.
What is the craziest or most extensive commission piece or request that you've gotten?
Make a lamp. It's a collaborative effort with one of a local metal artist. And it's an oak tree, but he bends the steel rods and makes this amazing kind of gnarled live oak tree. They weigh about 50 pounds. It's just beautiful. And we make a nice big lampshade to go on top of it. And one of the first big commissions we had, a large corporate client came in and they liked the lamp, bought the lamp, and then came back later and said, "So I want one of these, but I need it in the lobby of this office building. And I want it on the ceiling. And I want it to be 14 feet across. Can you do that?" And we just said, yes, we'll have to talk to Jimmy, but I think so. And we talked to the metal artist, and he did the same thing. He's like, "Ooh, I think so. If they're willing to pay for it, I think I can do whatever." So he kind of laid it out, had to guess about how much metal that would take and how much that would weigh. And they had to re-engineer the ceilings in the lobby, and we wound up making three of them.
Wow.
So there's adjacent lobbies and one going kind of long one going down a hallway in between.
So he had a low boy semi-trailers hauling it.
Yeah. Yeah. He had to design it so that each arm could be taken apart and it would fit back together once we got there, and I had to get it all, the whole thing wired with, I think, 60 different fixtures on each one, and we had to make 60 different matching lampshades for each one.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was an intense year of work to get that done.
Job security.
Yeah, yeah. At least for a little while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was intense.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this for 17 years, and you said basically it's do or die. Like, everyone, you either start it and you quit, or you stick through and you are a glass blower, like, for life. Like, what does that mean to you?
It means I get to play with fire all day.
Yeah.
It's really hot in there, especially in the summer, but it's still so rewarding just to be able to make things all day, every day, making something that someone will come in here and they just go, "Wow, I need that thing." I mean, even the weird one-off experimental things that we make when we're just feeling like having fun. It's like, you know what? We'll still put that out in the gallery. We'll still show that to people. someone will find it and go, I need that thing. That's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I love it.
That's how I felt about that purple thing.
Exactly.
I'm like, wow.
Exactly.
Is it a lantern? Is it a whale or a lantern? I want it. The color too.
Exactly.
But so, will you ever retire, or will you ever do something different? Pursue a different artistic form? I don't know. Sounds like we're not going to get you off art anytime soon.
No,
or that creative process.
But. Yeah, definitely not getting off of art anytime soon. I mean, there's always other things to do on the side.
So no.
Do some woodwork. Do some drawing.
Yeah.
But no, I will not stop making glass unless I have to. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a great morning here.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to learn more about your world at Wimberley Glassworks, where would you direct us?
Our website is just wgw.com. We've got a lot of information on there, the history of the company, and a lot of our designs and everything that we make, we try and make available for everybody.
Cool.
My name is Wes Sweetser, and I'm the head glassblower at Wimberley Glassworks.
Wes, thank you so much for sharing.
Anytime. Thank you, Tom.
It's been great. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Wimberley, Texas. We'll see you here.
As I mold, press some ribs into the glass. So we press some ribs in there, then we'll take that form and roll it over this thin layer of crushed up colored glass. That just sticks to the edges of the ribs to give us some colored accent. We need to put a line in here so we have a place to break it off once we're done blowing it out.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.